Hi, Lucy Eaton here, host of Hear Me Out. Quick heads up that the episode you're about to enjoy is a highlights reel from the full interview with this guest, so be sure to listen to the full fat version if you haven't already. And while I've got you, I wanted to let you know that we are officially now on Patreon. This means that you can invest in the channel monthly, and in return you get all kinds of perks. Just head to our page on patreon.com/podhearmeout. We've popped the link in the show notes below, and we would love to have you join the family.
Yeah, when I think of the speech, I've never really reflected on the speech as an intrinsic part of the work. I've always thought of the speech as something that's taken out of context. And, excuse me, it's something we always did for auditions back in the olden times.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
You do your modern and your classic when you went in for an audition, which that's kind of vanished now when you're auditioning for a rep or something. Yeah. But to think of the speech as an intrinsic part of the work, I thought, well, how is the speech figured or featured in my work? And I can't think of a play where it hasn't featured. I was at Mountview Theatre School.
Yes.
And prior to that, I was at this Method studio in Dublin. And
brilliant.
I trained there and I toured Ireland as a stage manager. And I was very invested in the culture and the writing. Mm. So I was fairly knowledgeable by the time I arrived at drama school. And I was broke, you know, and invited to audition for a scholarship.
Great.
So I fused two speeches from Philadelphia, Here I Come. And there's a great symmetry to
brilliant
that.
Brilliant play.
And I fused them together to create, brilliant play, yeah, to create this story, this, you know, this story arc, so you could take it out of context and tell a whole story. Yeah. So I auditioned for the scholarship, and it was a big deal. You know, it was the only one they were giving. It was a full scholarship. And on the panel, there was about six people, including Judi Dench.
Oh,
you might remember this.
No.
Yeah. So by the time I'd done this speech, Judi Dench was crying. She was at the back of the stalls, kind of gently weeping. And I thought, I'm in. Made the Dench weep. This is good.
Yes.
And she loved it. And the other speech, and this was a real...
Sorry, that is the coolest. You can't just move on from that, Brendan. That is the coolest thing ever. That beats like any other award, any other accomplishment.
It's cool, isn't it?
Like you made the Dench cry.
I made the Dench cry.
And like as a young
so
man.
I'm in.
That's very impressive.
Thank you. And I directed Dancing at Lunasa at my old drama school. So Freelsmin is featured.
Big part of your life. Yeah. But why is Conor McPherson, why do you place him on a higher pedestal? Or do you not?
I place him on the highest pedestal. Mm. I'm more than obsessed. And he's had an enormous influence, not just on my work, but on my life. He was writer in residence at the Bush Theatre.
Yes.
And he wrote a play called This Lime Tree Bower.
Great.
And I was obsessed with this play. The writing just knocked me out. And I did something I've never done before. I went to see it repeatedly. I must have seen it about 10 times or something. I've never done it. And I would be dragging people down and say, listen to this. And they'd be listening to this writing, savouring this writing.
Yeah.
It just struck a chord in me that no writer ever had to that extent.
Yeah.
Never had. But one evening, Conor had written this piece. It was a monologue, a speech called St. Nicholas. And he'd rehearsed it in Dublin with Brian Cox. He offered it to the great Brian Cox.
Oh, great.
Now, you have to remember, this guy is 26, 27 at this time. An interesting fact about The Weir, Ian Rickson told me that when they got the play, they handed it out to their dramaturgs and their various readers and the board. And he said they all came back unanimously and said, there's nothing to change here. There's not a single word.
Perfection.
There's not a single notion. It's perfect play.
Wow.
You can't touch this.
Yeah.
And he said that it hadn't happened before.
No.
So anyway, I went to see this play and I sat down again. It was like the Lime Tree Bower. It just kind of washed over me and it just slapped me around. And I was like, this is mind-blowing. And so I vowed to do it. I think I was about 30 and this character's supposed to be in his mid-50s. And I said, I'm going to do that.
I am
going to do it.
Yeah.
And so I did.
Yes, you did.
This is where we're landing on my favourite.
It's been a good prologue. A very good prologue.
Yeah. When I saw it with Brian Cox, it was very stark. He came on stage. It was one lighting stage, no set.
Right.
And he moved around to a couple of positions, and it was dependent entirely on the writing and the delivery of the performance, which were formidable.
Yeah.
But for me, I wanted theatre. I wanted a set. I wanted a soundscape. I wanted a lighting show.
Yes.
I wanted a great director. I wanted magic. You know?
Yeah.
And along came
Who does
Simon
magic
Evans.
Better than Simon Evans?
Who does magic? He is magic. He's a magician. He's your brother, right?
Yeah.
He is a magician in every sense of the word. He's a member of the magic circle. In tea breaks, he would do, close-hand magic, which was mind-blowing. But more than that, he's a magical director, and being in a room with him.
Yeah.
You know, to have been around the block so many times, and then to think, it gets better. You can still have your best experience, which is what it was, being in that room with Simon.
How was this your first time doing something where you were alone on stage for the entirety of it?
Yes, it is. And that's one of the reasons I was so sort of hesitant. I mean, it sat next to my bed, this play, for a long time. And I'd pick it up and I'd look at it and go, two things. I can't learn this. It's 90 minutes. And it's not just one note. It's, you know, it goes here, there, and everything. It's intense. You know?
Yeah,
it's
real challenge.
And also I thought, can you hold an audience for 90 minutes like that on your own? I thought, no, I wasn't sure if I wanted to do it. I wasn't sure if I could do it. Mm. The one new year, it was a resolution. I thought, just learn the first page. And I did. And I was off. I was up and running.
Yeah.
And by then I put it out there to such an extent that people were running with it. And it was kind of no going back. And but once I started working with Simon, I said to Simon, I remember saying this very early on. I said, well, you know, the thing is, I mean, if it's lit in such a way, I won't be able to see anybody. So it'll just be me and I'll be all right. As long as I can't see anything, we're not doing that. he said, this is a two-hander. It's you and the audience.
Nice.
And he said, and when we first did it, he said, not only are you going to see them, you're going to walk among them. Mm. We touch them on the shoulder, and kind of, because there's a supernatural element to this play, just to freak them out for no other reason, really. and so he was quite adamant that I was going to have this direct connection with, ideally, every single member of the audience. So there were some nights, I remember I was filming the Downton Abbey film at the time, and driving into Covent Garden at 4 or 5 o'clock, knackered, you know, getting my Pret sandwich and soup, and I'd be lying in the dressing room on my couch, going, oh God, I can't do this, I'm exhausted. As soon as I went out there and said the first line, boom, we're in, it's adrenaline, it's connection. It was electric. So there was never a bad night. It was never a struggle.
What was your favourite moment in it? Was there a favourite moment to get to in the whole story?
Ooh. there were so many of them. Little explosive moments. I love the kind of melodious riffing. I love the intensity, the bitterness. Mm. I love the offensiveness of it. I love to shock. Mm. I love the laughs we used to get. You know, it's always great when you get a laugh.
Yeah.
I love the uplifting, soulful stuff at the end.
Who do we have here?
I hear the voice. I hear
Who
his voice.
This? Who is this?
Hello. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hello, young man.
I mean, to see Brendan talk to someone and to see Brendan hear that somebody is cackling at something and finding something particularly just the way that the text, certainly with someone like Brendan, can just sort of, it can make everyone in the audience feel more seen and more alive than sort of any other form of it. And I think it's the magician in me. I just get off on that in a big way.
Well, a couple of things about that. I avoided the term one man play or one person play, because I was explaining to Lucy, I went out there with a team, you know, I went out with Connor and you and Christopher and Matt and Peter and Becky, you know, so we were the team. So one man show, one person show seemed a bit disingenuous to me, but, you know, a bit misleading.
Brendan is, in fact, one of the nicest people in the world. So I hope you take it in the spirit that it was intended, Brendan, when I say it took a little bit to get you to embrace your full nastiness early on in those rehearsals. Mm. Like sort of early on, I think there was as every good actor had, there was a sort of desire to protect your character and to sort of treat him with love and to go, no, he is a good person. Let me show you how this is a good person. It took a little bit of time for me to say to Brendan, no, he's not. He's not a good person.
Simon, was it something you knew of at all before Brendan brought it to you, St. Nicholas?
I had read it at one point because I actually worked in the education department at the Donmar when they did The Night Alive, which I think before girl from the North Country was the first new Connor play in a while. So I'd sort of, so I met Connor and interviewed him for the Donmar and sort of just read everything I could of his. So read St. Nicholas, but I confess bits of it gripped me, but I sort of read it in that quite perfunctory way when you're sort of reading everything to get a sense of what's this author about. But no, it was when Brendan mentioned it again that I sort of went back and read it and went, how did this, this pass me by?
Bit of me.
Yeah, I think it did feel very me, but also when Brendan and I chatted, it felt like it was a bit of him as well. I hope that's all right, Brendan. But it felt like it spoke to both of us in different but very compatible ways. And you know, I have become, as I've got a little bit older, more and more interested in work that, yeah, just an audience feel alive in. And just you read that opening page and you just go, God, people aren't gonna know what's going on. They're going to have to be alive in this because it doesn't pander to any easy understanding, and yet is somehow not obscure either. And then, you know, we had this session and Brendan read it for the first time, and you know, I'll never forget that. It remains one of those things that if I think I'd seen it and someone else had done it, I'd have gone, oh.